This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I'm very curious. I feel very deeply if there's a problem. You have to just stare it in the face and move forward. I'm not very patient for things that are not working. How do businesses work and how do you understand the basic challenges in a business? So I learned to code, taught myself, actually, after a couple of classes.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more.
On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm talking to Nicola Hodson. Now, as many of you might know, Nicola is the CEO of IBM for UK and Ireland. And Nicola has a long and distinguished career in technology. Now, that all started with her time at Liverpool University. We'll talk about that and the degree she did there and also the PhD she did there. But before that, Nicola, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, where I'd like to start is your early years. I'm always keen to know, was there anything in your childhood that made you come into the career that you have come into with technology?
I'm dating myself here, but you may remember Encyclopedia Britannica. We had that at home and we used to get Reader's Digest and there were, you know, from being very, very young, I used to sit on the floor with my father and there was a section in there about Concorde. And we were on the flight path for Concorde, so you could see it. But we used to sort of stare at these pictures and it was cross sections through Concorde. So you could see, you know, the engines, the seat deconstructed, etc. And I was absolutely fascinated just by the how, you know, wow, how does that work? And how does that thing fly? And I could see it as well. So that really kind of, when you look back, created a spark for me. The town I grew up in was very heavily involved in the chemical industries. And so that was sort of all around me. And then nearby, we had some car manufacturing and things. So it was sort of natural in a sense when you look back. And the other influence, I remember much later, you know, in my late teens, there was John Harvey Jones with Troubleshooter. And I used to love the program. And so I was sort of fascinated by science and tech, but also how do businesses work and how do you understand the basic challenges in a business and get them moving in a good direction. So yeah, that was the genesis. So I put it all down to my father.
And in terms of at school, you must have been good at sciences at school.
Yeah, I was. I was really, really encouraged. I went to a infants junior school. I went back to see them last year, actually, which was phenomenal. But I had an amazing teacher there. I'll say his name just in case there's anyone who also was taught by him. It's called Mr. Bickerstaff. And he was really, really encouraging. And he sort of really fostered a natural curiosity in me, which very, very much shaped me and helped me to do better and better. And the same when I went to senior school, actually, I had a really inspiring, she was a chemistry teacher, and we'll talk more about her as we go through as well. But I think the teaching really helps. Sense that other people have got faith in you and that builds confidence. And it's a real theme for me in terms of how do you think about people and building confidence and helping them to be what they genuinely can become.
At school, when you did your A-levels, I'm assuming that you did sciences. You were drawn in that direction.
Yes, I did maths, chemistry, physics, and something that was called general studies. I think it's still going to have lots of politics and stuff in it. So, yeah, I did sciences. You know, I was naturally stronger in that area, and I was interested to do more. And I quite like the problem solving. I didn't really love writing essays either, so it was a fairly easy choice for me.
And Nicola, there's lots of talk about the relative paucity of women in top jobs in engineering, technology. When you were at school, were there many girls who were doing science A levels? How did that feel?
You know, I was really lucky to go to an independent school, and so I did 11 plus. And before you get to the sort of science bit, I would say the really important thing I got from my school was the importance of a sense of aspiration. You know, you were going to go on to do something and to make a big contribution. And I think if you get that, the rest necessarily follows. And so, and then, you know, they were very, very encouraging. They actually, the school was really encouraging around science. In reality, they were sort of trying to funnel girls towards medicine. So hence science, pretty important. But, you know, that wasn't for me. Maybe we'll talk a bit more about that. But they definitely did encourage lots of girls in science and technology. You know, if I think of my A-level classes, they were full. They were full classes, and there were two sets way back then. So, yeah, it was not a minority subject choice at that school at all.
So let's pick up that theme then about medical or engineering, because you went to Liverpool University and you went there to study mechanical engineering, and then you got a PhD there as well. So why that and not medicine? Particularly, say, as you said, you had a very inspirational chemistry teacher.
You know, some of these choices are quite fickle when you look back, aren't they? I decided I didn't want to do medicine because it was too long to spend at university, and I ended up staying there for 6 years anyway. However, I decided against that, but I, after much persuasion from my school, I was the first in my family to go to university. So I didn't, you know, my dad was great, just said, like, get a great education. It gives you choices and freedom. And so I listened to that, and then I just listened to people at school, and I managed to persuade myself that if I wasn't going to do medicine, I'd do dentistry. And so I sort of did all the forms, got some places at university. About 2 weeks before I went to university, I decided to do the obvious thing and spend a week with a dentist. And my father's friend happened to have a practice, so I went along there. And you know, he did a few simple things, and then he started to do a root canal. And I was just thinking, this is so not for me. I can tell you to this day, I was focused on a wasp in the window, so I didn't have to look at what was happening. And I really just thought, I can't do this. It's not for me. It was good in a way. I flushed that out early. I almost didn't go to university. I was applying for jobs. I was offered a job in a bank, and the reference landed on my ex-headmistress's desk the morning I was due to start university, and I wasn't planning to go at this point. And she said, you know, don't be ridiculous, go to the university, tell them you want to change course if that's what you want, and see what happens. So I went along, I joined the dentistry course, I bought the skeleton and all the books, vast cost. And met the, you know, you all work on a cadaver. And I lasted 3 days, and I thought, I can't do it. So I went along to the students' union. I said, I can't do my course. I need to change course. And they said, well, it's good that you've come in the first week. Which course would you like to do? Obvious question. So I thought, oh, wasn't really ready for that question. But I'd been along with, my chemistry teacher was amazing. She'd been to Liverpool University, and she studied chemistry and material science. So I said, I'll do chemistry and material science. And I was moved course, and it was a really brilliant choice for me, as it happens, you know, serendipity and all of that. But it was a great course. It was quite applied. I'm naturally quite applied. Don't love theory for the sake of it. And so it was great. It turned out really, really well. and I managed to give away my dentistry books, and I'm very grateful for dentists, but it's definitely not my passion.
Not for you. And then you stayed on to do a PhD. So what? Tell us about your PhD and what you decided to focus on.
Yeah, I did my PhD. I was sponsored. There was a new professor came to the university with a set of industrial lasers, and he was offering some really interesting PhDs. And I'd done well in my degree, and so you know, I went along to have a chat with him, and he had some sponsorship from the automotive industry. It was a company called TNN Technology at the time, and they made engine components. And they wanted to see if you could use these lasers to harden the metals and make the components last longer. So if you think about your car engine, in there are a number of valves, and they're bashing up and down at gazillions of times a second, and they're hitting metal on metal. And I was working on the impact surface to basically to powder coat it, but melt the powder at the same time to harden them. And it was 3 years long. I did lots of materials engineering, obviously, but I did a lot of work on a finite element model to model the heat flow. So I learned to code. I taught myself, actually, after a couple of classes, and got to model this, and I was quite amazed that you could, you know, do something with code that gave you these beautiful heat maps, basically colored 3D, and model the behavior of the metal. So you know, it turned out to be quite interesting. It was very applied, as I say. I worked with TNN, so they had lots of factories around the UK, and I got to see how the valves were made, how they were tested, and stuff. And the work actually then later went into production, so it was really useful at the same time as you know, as pushing forward. You always say, when you look at a PhD, you think, wow, pushing back the boundaries of science. And you know, each incremental step is a step, but you have to really work hard to find your niche. And it was very interesting for me, because when it came to then look at the job market, you have to think quite deeply about what transferable skills do you have. And it's, when I look back on it, your first day, you're basically sat at a desk with other people's research, and you've got to find, like, what do I study? What do I work on? How do I construct it? And so you're very much there with a blank sheet of paper. And it's sort of, in later life, you know, I always know now that if I'm put into a different environment that I know nothing about, pretty much, I can find my way through it and make sense of it and figure out what's the next logical thing to do.
So having done that PhD, Nicola, which was very specific, were you very clear about what you wanted to go and do when you went into the world of work?
I was very clear that I didn't really want to work in research. So I did the obvious thing and took a job in research. I went to work. You know, I enjoyed the science. I really enjoyed the science. I enjoyed the application of the science into industrial practice. But I didn't really enjoy the lab work per se. And so I went to work at a company called BNFL, British Nuclear Fuels. They were in the Northwest, and they were building out a brand new research lab. And it was going to look at, you know, all things nuclear, and you would have your own research area, and you would also sponsor and work with universities and other companies on a portfolio of research. So lab wasn't ready. I started work, great group of people, you know, all the same age, and got really stuck into partnerships with universities and other companies, and enjoyed that. And as the lab opening got closer and closer, my colleagues were getting very excited. And I just thought, I don't really want to be measured in my career on how many patents I create. I don't want to go back into the lab. I need to look around for something else. And so I started looking for other jobs in other companies, and I went to speak to my boss and said, look, I think this is probably not for me. Here are the parts of it I love. Here are the parts that probably don't work for me. And he, with hindsight, it was very smart of him, actually. He sent me to see his boss's boss, and she was female. She's been on Desert Island Discs. She's awesome. She's called Dr. Dame Sue Eon, and she was incredible. She was so supportive. She said to me, you know, what's happening and all of this. And then she said, what do you want to do? Because I was set to leave. And I said, well, I'd been to your other site. I met this guy. He looked really interesting. He's going to do a job in the corporate center for you. I like to work for him. And she said, great, when do you want to start? And she was really, you know, that's a special leader who does that, because she hardly knew me. And she put me into his team. And it was fantastic. It was a team that was, they had a very big technology portfolio, big R&D budget. And he had a team that was looking at make or buy decisions. You know, do we research in this area, or is someone else further ahead and we should partner with them? Or actually, is the technology already developed to an extent we just buy it? And so it's much more commercial, back into the sort of business that I was very interested in. And using the science and technology experience. And then I had the pleasure of setting up the HIM. We realized there wasn't much competitive intelligence in going through some of this work to look at the different areas. And they gave me the reins to set up a competitive intelligence unit super early in my career. It was brilliant. They gave me lots of rope, and you know, it was good add to the company, because it really saved money for things that were more important and allowed us to jump forward on the back of some good partnerships with others.
And you went on to do an MBA at Lancaster University. How did that come about?
Yeah, I applied for that. BNFL had a scheme. I knew I wanted to go in that direction, by the way, because, you know, I'd said about John Harvey Jones. I knew I understood research, but I wanted to do something much more in the heart of the business and the commercial side of it. And so I applied through a company scheme. Everyone said, oh, well, you're too young. They don't sponsor people at your stage in career. And I thought, well, I'll just apply anyway. And they did sponsor me. And it was a modular course, 2 years. And you would do a week at the university as part of a cohort. And then you would come back and do a project in your company. So got to work on some great projects, you know, really diverse, financials, operational stuff, strategy. Did my final dissertation in corporate strategy, and as part of it, moved to the corporate strategy team, and taught myself into a fantastic job leading a big strategy project that the company was doing on the back of a new chief executive coming in. So it was really just fortuitous. Early in my career, I was a bit pushy, and it all sort of fell into place and helped me to make the set of moves that got me really off to the races.
So before we then go on to talk about what you did moving through to be where you are now at IBM, just a few things to reflect on, really. First of all, your courage to go to your boss and say, I don't think this job is right for me. Your courage at university to say, I don't think dentistry medicine is right for me, and to change. So twice in your early years, you've made big decisions about being honest about how you feel and moving on. And then also that big leap from thinking I'm science-based into actually I'm business science-based and doing that. So what do you think it is about your personality or character that gave you the confidence to go and see those bosses and just say, look, I'm not happy. I think I need to do something else.
I don't know. Maybe it's stubbornness or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm not very patient for things that are not working. I'm very curious. I don't see a point in, you know, I feel very deeply if there's a problem, you have to just stare it in the face and move forward I'm not one to admire problems from every different angle. So pretty much once I've registered a problem, I'm right, okay, now I just need to fix this. How am I going to fix it? And I think it's always good to have that candid conversation, isn't it? Because you get to know yourself very well, especially in business. You know, we do lots of leadership courses and lots of self-analysis, and you do get to understand yourself very well. And I know very deeply in my heart, I'm either 100% on or I'm switched off. And I don't want to be there because it's a psychologically bad place. It doesn't help me to perform at my best. I don't therefore appear at my best. And, you know, you sort of close down and stop learning. And so I'm very much sort of, how do I do something I'm really passionate about that captures my energy and my curiosity and allows me to keep moving? So I think it's, you know, it's about how do I be in that space and not someplace over here that I know is not a happy place for me.
And how have all those experiences affected the way that you manage? What have you learned from them? How might it have shaped the way that you run IBM today?
You know, you learn all through the intervening period. I don't think the leadership journey's ever done, is it? And so I think you would see in my leadership today a few things. One, I'm very conscious of my own weak spots, if you like. And so I like to have a team around me that complements me, but that also really challenges my thinking. I think that's really important because you can, if not careful, you can get into a situation where you think you've got all the answers. And frankly, whoever does at the top of an organization. And so, you know, I like that sort of to push ideas around, to challenge thinking, to test them. I don't like a team where everyone agrees. And then I think it's really important to listen to people, to listen what they want, how they want to operate. I think COVID really taught us the importance of understanding people at a human level if we didn't know it before. And to get a sense of who is this person I'm working with? What are they all about? What's important to them? Why are they who they are? And how do I work with them so that they can be their best and I can support them? And paying that individual attention. And then when you think about how do you scale that across an organization, then I think it's about making sure that you create the climate in which the scope for everyone to succeed if that's what they want to do. And most people do, let's face it. And so, you know, creating opportunities, making sure that they are for all forms of diverse and inclusive people in the organization. I spend my most enjoyable meetings of the diversity and inclusion work. It's the diversity and inclusion work I do. I have something called the Inclusion Council with a bunch of different business resource groups from all different parts of the diversity spectrum. And I get to work with the sponsors of those groups, but most importantly, I get to work with the early in career folk who are part of those groups. And when you really hear about some of the challenges people face, it gives you just a very different lens on what can I sensibly do to support them? What can the organization do to support them? And how do I talk to people in a way that they can understand and tap their personal potential into what the company wants to do? And so all of that, I would say, it's made me a much more human leader and in a sense, kinder, although, you know, we're in business, we have to deliver. But there's a space for humanity and kindness in there. And I think if you can get to that, you get a whole new level of connection, inspiration and followership than you ever get if you just talk at a thinking level. You have to be able to tap into people and how they feel and who they are. Long answer.
It's a brilliant summary of you and your leadership style and how it's developed. And what I'm really keen to know now is all about how you're using that and the challenges you're facing at IBM and the opportunities. But before we get to that, just for our listeners, because I know your background, but British Nuclear Fuels, you've done your MBA at Lancaster. Just walk us through now what happens from completing that to becoming the CEO of IBM.
So I moved to corporate strategy, as I said, at BNFL, and I went to interview my inspiration. I went to interview the chairman as part of my project, forgot to ask any of the managers in the middle, and turned up at his office in London. Had a great interview, happened to come back on the train, and one of the ex-com members was on the train, a brilliant, brilliant leader called David Bonser, and had a good chat on the train on the way home. And I was pretty, you know, working for someone at the time who really, really didn't inspire me, really didn't inspire me. And I was, you know, in that process of thinking, is this for me or not? And I said to him, you know, asked me how it's going. I said, I'm pretty bored in this role. And he said, do you want to come and work for me? So I said, yes, when can I start? And he said, tomorrow. And I was like, great. And he asked me to be the client program director for a strategy review with Bain Consulting. It was the biggest change program in the UK at the time. It was a massive, massive bet, but it was brilliant. It was, you know, root and branch, looking at how did the company make money, how did we organize ourselves, etc. Big reorg, big change program, got to lead the implementation in large part, and got to the end of it. We delivered pretty much 25% cost savings. It was a very big piece of work and huge experience for me. We're implementing SAP, PeopleSoft, the whole works. And so all aspects of the company changing, trade unions, staff unions, the whole bit. Fabulous, fabulous experience. I got to the end of it and I was looking around with him at what I might do. And I think we both came to the conclusion, like I didn't want to run a nuclear plant because I quite like innovation. You do not want innovation there. And the other option would be corporate functions, and wasn't really excited. So I left. It was super hard to leave because it was like my family. And I'd been there for 9 years or something. I did leave. I went to join EY as management consultant to work on other transformation programs, which I'd really enjoyed. I was there for a couple of years. Didn't love aspects of it. I enjoyed the thinking works. I worked with various utilities and some of the big oil companies and stuff in the energy sector on how to transform their businesses, different parts of it. I enjoyed the thinking, but you didn't really get to do the implementation. And so I left after a couple of years. I went to a company which was called CSC, is now called DXC, in the tech industry. And they were very much doing the taking the thinking and doing the implementation. So they did IT consulting, and they did projects around SAP, Oracle, PeopleSoft implementations. They did applications management. They did big outsourcing contracts. It was lots new to me. And I went with a team. All of us went at the same time, five of us. And we set up a energy and utilities practice. And we got stuck into some really, really interesting projects. It was very commercial. Everything I learned about contract negotiation, I learned from them. They were super smart, great lawyers, great financial analysts, and they did some brilliant, brilliant work. Got to do some massive bids, huge global ones. You know, I think the biggest one I worked on was $7 billion, massive outsource. So it was fabulous experience. It was a whole different world. You know, if you wanted commerciality, you were right at the sharp end. Got to build some new propositions, stayed there for about 5 years, loved it. American, you know, very get up and go. And I was headhunted to join Siemens. Siemens had, CSC at the time was competing with two other companies, IBM and what was EDS. And they were competing for big outsource contracts in essence. And it was very, very, very competitive, you know, in a way that we probably wouldn't see in the same way today, you know, like people poking at each other and sending each other weird gifts. And it was fun. It was huge fun. Very competitive, very big money involved. You know, win rates were 50-50 at best. You'd spend a lot and you would fight really, really hard to win. I was headhunted to join Siemens. It was a more senior role. It was a UK management board role. They were much smaller, like in the league table, they were 10th. And I got the offer to run sales, marketing, bid management for UK and Ireland. And it most people thought I was nuts to go there. Didn't do great due diligence because when I got there, I looked at the pipeline, put it all immediately in the bin and thought, right, I need to start from scratch. I need to build a team. And then my boss said, like, you know, we need to grow to this size. And I was looking at the league tables and thinking, I've got to go from 10th to 5th. That's a big haul. How am I going to do that? And so, you know, built a team. We did the growth. We outgrew the industry 3x for 3 years in a row. We went for a really hairy bid. The biggest, I think it's, I don't know if it's still the biggest outsource that was done in the UK, but it was with the BBC. It was very audacious. We came from nowhere. We beat some of the big rivals and we won it. Doing so, we doubled the size of our company. So I got to do some really, really exciting stuff. It was not something we could do alone, but I brought in a bunch of different partners, you know, Deloitte and a couple of others, big partners. And then I got to do the integration work and the whole Sarbanes-Oxley that was around it at the time. So it was just phenomenal experience, really fast. Again, really reasonably early in my career to get that level of experience. And yeah, loved it. The company changed its structure. And so they wanted to focus on slightly different sectors. With hindsight, you know, if I'd been a bit more audacious, I tried, but I couldn't get my colleagues excited enough. But I wanted to do a management buyout and couldn't get people around it at the time. And so they ultimately divested of the business and sold it to Atos. But I'd left maybe a year before that. I was headhunted to go to Microsoft. And I spent nearly 15 years there, knew pretty much nothing about software when I got there, got to lead their public sector business and drive significant growth. Then I was chief operating officer for the UK business. And it was great because it had, you know, it was about two thirds commercial, B2B, and then about a third consumer. I know that's your old world. It's like it's a totally different ball game. So I got to learn the consumer business. It was fantastic. We worked with all of the big retailers to, you know, sell things like Xbox, Surface, Office 365, etc. It was the time when Microsoft was building its e-commerce channel. So it was a very exciting time. I had all of the marketing, all of the advertising for the UK market executed from here. Got to work with the big agencies. It was fun. It was a real ride. And it was, you know, similar. All of those journeys, by the way, have got massive change in performance required. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to drive that multiple times. I wound up at Microsoft leading the global transformation for sales, marketing, and operations. I worked for, again, a brilliant leader, Jean-Philippe Courtois, and I learned so much from him, but he was running sales, marketing, and operations globally. And we did some work to look at what does competition look like in the future. It's quite well written about now, the Microsoft transformation, as part of Satya's journey. You know, I was focusing on sales, marketing, and operations part of it. It was really exciting. It was a global job. Microsoft is very global. And so got to work with all different 14 different regions as there were at the time. Got to spend lots of time in Asia, in the US, redesigning basic building blocks of a massive organization. And then the really important part was, how do you, when you've had so much change, how do you then drive a culture change? Because you can build all the building blocks you like, but if people are not behaving differently, guess what? You're not going to get the results. And so we embarked on a huge effort to change the culture. I have to hand it to my boss. He was brilliant. He embraced change himself. He role modeled it. He made himself very vulnerable. And that set the example for everyone else to follow. And he, you know, I convinced him and the company to invest in the biggest discretionary effort in the year, to invest in a coaching program for managers. And it was great. We designed it with an external company. We did a lot of work to make it really relevant for our managers. But, you know, in a sales organization, you can have people inspecting and you can have people coaching and anywhere on that spectrum. And you get way by way the best. I think the stats say about 5x performance if all of your managers are coaching. And so that, I think, is, you know, is definitely something I'm really, really in favor of. And just, you know, putting the energy and effort into development and having managers coach and get the best out of their people and help clients to figure out what it is they really want and how we can help them. So that was it. I came here 15 months ago. You know, IBM's in a really, really interesting spot, obviously transforming in many ways itself under Arvind's leadership. It's a pretty exciting time to join. And it's a very exciting time to be in tech right now.
And so, as you say, 15 years in Microsoft, but amazing experience elsewhere. What was it that tempted you to leave Microsoft to go to IBM?
You know, I'd been in a global role for about 5 years. I really wanted to get my hands back on the reins and drive a P&L and work very closely with clients and partners to drive change. I get my energy from my client conversations and the partner conversations. And so I wanted to get into that. IBM is at a really interesting juncture because if you look at what's going on in tech, you know, there are a couple of big themes. AI is obviously one. And IBM's been in AI for many, may remember the Gary Kasparov chess competition many years ago. So it's a big, big name there in the B2B space in AI. If you look at, I don't think I've come across a single organization who isn't in a hybrid cloud scenario, i.e. they're running their technology partly in the public cloud, partly in other clouds, partly on premise, to give themselves flexibility for the future. So that's another big tech theme, and IBM's very big in that space with flexible architecture that helps clients there. And then if you sort of draw the circle back to my materials science, material engineering days, IBM's got an incredible track record in innovation and is doing some just really outstanding work in quantum computing and the next generation of compute. And we have a brilliant, brilliant R&D team globally, but here in the UK and Ireland as well. And so, you know, when you put together a tech portfolio that addresses the big trends. We have a great consulting business, very strong in the UK and Ireland, with deep, deep, deep industry expertise. So you can have really relevant and detailed conversations with clients and help them. And then with the R&D capability as well, I think you've got something that's quite different in the tech sector. It's, I think we're unique in that sense, and therefore, you know, a great combination to, if you can put that together well, to offer something different to clients. And IBM bought Red Hat a few years ago. Red Hat is fundamentally part of that hybrid cloud architecture as well. So great set of capabilities. The job is then really, how do you harness that benefit of your clients? And you get to work on some really, really interesting stuff.
So taking all that you've done, I mean, you've had the most amazing career, worked for some incredible companies, and moved from being science-based into management and commercial. So given all of that journey, when you look at the opportunities you now have at IBM, what's top of your priority list? What are you most focused on doing?
You know, if you think about where our clients are at, then from their perspective, the main thing is, how do you harness AI and do it within an appropriate set of guardrails to get the benefits of productivity and drive the growth that you want to drive? And so, you know, a big part of our work is how do we help clients on that journey from thinking it through to implementing to production and really driving benefits. And I would say that's the main job of work. Obviously, as part of that, people have to understand what we do, and taking IBM to a wider audience of clients is also important. And so we do a lot now with smaller businesses where they're starting on those journeys and working to help them. So that's the first one. And think of that as the AI and hybrid cloud portfolio coming to life for those clients. The second is working with our ecosystem of partners. You'll know from your own business career, you know, technology's great, but you've got to be able to implement and adopt it in a good way. And so when you think of the sheer scale of business transformation, digital transformation that has to happen across even like just the UK and Ireland to drive economic growth, it's big, and no company can do that alone. And so part of our work is to mobilize a whole ecosystem of partners that can help clients on that journey and get the best and get the value out of the technology. So that's the second one, I would say. And then it comes a lot down to people and culture, and how do you make this an exciting and interesting place to work? How do you help people to feel energized and engaged with what the company wants to do? And how do you create opportunities for their personal and career growth within that? So they would be, you know, they would be the big tenets of, you know, at the sort of 70,000 foot level. There's loads of detail underneath, as you'd expect, but you know, getting those things right and making sure we've got the right talent to succeed. And then we get to do some really sort of quirky, interesting, exciting projects. You know, we do a lot of work in sport. So we work with Wimbledon and the US Masters and the Open, and we apply AI. So I don't know if you saw the Wimbledon app last year. You know, it's doing AI predictions at each match stage of who's going to win. It's doing AI commentary if you missed the match. So you get to do some really interesting projects, some with NGOs, a lot with the government, and really sort of see technology go into action in a way that people can understand. Companies like IBM working alongside the government and academia and companies to figure out, how do you harness this technology in a thoughtful way with appropriate regulation and making sure you've got the guardrails in place that it can be harnessed in a successful way. And I didn't want to miss that, because you can't go racing ahead without making sure you've got proper governance. You know, you're using AI to make important decisions about people, then you need to make sure it's making fair, ethical, transparent decisions, etc.
In conclusion, I just want to ask you again about STEM and women in STEM, because you've been hugely successful in your career. But it's, I think, the fact that there are relatively few women who've been successful compared to men. And you talked earlier about your passion for the D&I agenda and how involved you are in that. So what are your reflections today about why more women aren't in senior roles in tech? And what do you think has to be done to change that?
Let's start with AI, right? Because we just published a report today, and it basically says 2/3 of businesses recognize the importance of having, I'll choose women for the sake of diversity in this context, recognize the importance of having women as part of AI development and in the journey, so that you don't get bias in the way you develop these systems. But when you look at how many of them have got a serious agenda to enhance their AI leadership for women, the percentage of women in AI leadership positions, it's not 2/3, it's closer to 1/3. And so, you know, just to sort of say, as these technologies get more and more pervasive, it's so important that from the get-go, all the way through the development lifecycle, through to the implementation, you've got as diverse a population as possible building this technology, testing it, implementing, and then you get fairer, unbiased results. So I start there. As it relates to women in STEM, you will have heard, as I've gone through the conversation, the real importance of role models. I talked about my teachers, my chemistry teacher, my first female Uber boss. You know, being able to see people like you doing jobs like this, I think, is really important. Being able to show that you can do jobs like this and be vulnerable and be a person and be a mother and have a family and all of those things, I think, is really important. I think as it relates to STEM, some people think STEM's coding or STEM's maths. And I think we could maybe do a better job of saying, hey, STEM's a great basis of being able to understand and analyze problems and use a scientific method, which is quite rigorous. And having that basis for a career, any career in business, I think is just a really solid set of transferable skills. And so painting the picture of what's possible rather than, hey, I need to go study computer science. Or if I study computer science, I'm going to be a coder. Not necessarily, right? And I'm not in a chemistry lab. And so helping people to understand the breadth of opportunity possible when you've studied those courses. I think more than ever, you know, if you do understand coding in some form or another, most STEM courses give you a basic understanding of coding. You obviously get a lot deeper with computer science, but if you can get that basic understanding, you then know the building blocks, you start to know how a development lifecycle works, you can understand the core part of the business that you're in. So I would say, for me, it's a great baseline, but not to be restricted to, you know, necessarily, I study biology, I've got to have a job in a lab, because I think people can get quite focused. We spend a ton of effort on education. So I would say, whatever you do, whether you do STEM or you don't, I would encourage people to do STEM, because for all the reasons I said, it's a brilliant baseline. Whatever you study, I think it's really important to stay curious and to learn and to continue to learn. Companies, all of them in the tech sector, companies like ours at IBM, we've got this program called Skills Build. We are looking to train 30 million people in technology, digital technologies, 2 million in AI by 2026 It's all free on a website called IBM Skills Build. You can go and do a foundational AI course. I would encourage anyone listening, go do that, get your head around it a little bit, play with some of the online AI, you know, perplexity.ai, ChatGPT, any of them. I'm sure any of the, if any students out there, they've played with them all, I can tell you for sure. And just be curious. You don't need to necessarily go and build AI, but you do need, I think everyone needs a basic understanding of how can this help me with routine tasks that can be done better and quicker alongside me with the help of some AI. And that for any role in any business, I think is something people can do right now. And once you've started to explore, it doesn't feel so sort of over there someplace as something difficult. You know, some of these courses really start from basics and help people to figure out how should I think about this for my own career. Every job will change, and there'll be new jobs, and there'll be some jobs that don't exist anymore. But net, and if you look over the history of technology, more jobs have always been created than not. And if you think about your job, my job, you know, it'll just evolve quite quickly with AI helping us to mobilize. So yes, more girls in STEM. Leaders like me need to do more to inspire and to motivate and to talk to females along all stages of their career so that they can plow a successful way forward.
Well, if I may say so, Dr. Lynetta Hodson, you have been the most amazing inspiration. Listening to you for the last 45 minutes or so talk about your career, how you developed, it's a truly remarkable story, and it's great to now see you as CEO of IBM and with the passion to make the changes you talked about, to think about women, to think about developing people, coaching. So thank you very much for sharing your journey. Thank you for talking to us about how you see IBM going forward, and can I wish you every success in the future? Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been really great to chat with you.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.